Dr. Wendell Block, how are you today?
I'm pretty well, David. How are you doing?
I'm quite well, thank you. Where are you right now? Where am I speaking to you?
You're speaking to me. I'm in Iqaluit, up in Nunavut, the south end of Baffin Island, where it's about 1 degree. I'm looking out at, the snow's gradually melting off the hills, and leaving a lot of exposed rock and earth. It's kind of the weather we'd expect in early March in southern Ontario.
Oh, that sounds nice. Is it beautiful up there?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a melting and muddy time of year. I think it's a little more beautiful when it's in winter, and it'll be quite beautiful again in a month or so when the tundra is kind of starting to come out with more lichens and flowers and stuff. It's beautiful in its own way. A little bare right now.
Can you tell me about being in Iqaluit? Is this your first time there? How long have you been there? And I assume you're there for work.
Yeah, I'm up here doing family medicine locum at the local hospital here in the outpatient clinics. So I started coming up here in 2019. I came up a few times. Last year, because of the pandemic, I mean, 2020, I only came once for a very short time. And now this spring, I've started coming back. So I come for 3 to 6 weeks at a time and try to help out with the staff here and, try to do more good than harm.
Right.
It's I'm just learning a lot in this setting, and it's a pretty unique place.
So before we move on to discussing your work in Toronto, downtown Toronto, where our radio station is located, can you tell me a little bit of some of the learning you've had where you're working now, some of your experiences up north?
Well, I've been trying to keep my eyes and ears open and absorb what I can. I feel like, this is an interface kind of place between the evolution and development of the local Inuit population and the expanding settler population and it's kind of a unique place because of Nunavut's government, and they have a kind of self-government over the Nunavut territory. It's just really interesting to me to see how it all works out. And there's a lot that I still don't understand, and I'm grappling with, and I don't feel in a great position to say a lot, except that the changes that Inuit people have gone through, and in many ways been forced to go through over the last 100 years, in many ways even less than 100 years, in my own lifetime, it's just quite tremendous, and it's you can see the effects of the kind of coerced development that's happened here. But on the other hand, the world changes, everything changes, technology changes. It's just a matter of how much of that change is self-determined and how much isn't. And it's just a huge mixed bag of things up here.
Right. When I look at your career, there are several through lines, and one of them is the idea of the social determinants of both physical and mental health. When I attended George Brown College to be a community worker, that was a concept that was really bandied about, social determinants of health. Can you talk about how this kind of philosophy, this kind of focus affects your work, both up north, but also downtown where our radio station is located, through your work as a family physician at the East End Community Health Center?
Yeah, yeah. So when I, you know, for about 30 or more years, I worked in Toronto and community health centers, and I was helping out there this winter as well. And, you know, our efforts were really to work with people who often face barriers in getting health care and who have problems with their health related to, you know, as you mentioned, social determinants of health that create difficult histories, difficult problems, and difficult health trajectories for people. You know, in a lot of ways, our modern healthcare, it can do a lot, but one of the resources we often can't make available to people is just to give people enough time in our appointments and interactions with people, and we're kind of forced to rush through history taking and exam taking. We often want, you know, I would say that people who come to see us want to give us a more complete story, and many of us want to hear a more complete story, but time pressures make it difficult. Anyways, at community health centers, there is more of an awareness of the need for that, and one of the things that I like about that setup is as a family doctor, I always had fairly long appointments with people. You know, we could listen to people presenting more than one problem. We had time to get to know people, you know, at least a little better. And I certainly did have the chance to see the impact that different social determinants would have on people's health and well-being, you know, whether it was related to the access to education or employment they'd had or good food, you know, the kind of health literacy and access to, you know, our language of English that we used mostly. And other social determinants of health too, which are more personal, like what was their family life like? Did they feel secure and attached as a child? Did they have opportunities to be curious and grow? And then, you know, the opportunity to be free of social violence or political violence. A lot of our clients were refugees or had moved to Canada because of political and economic upheaval, and, you know, just having a living in a secure place where you could speak your mind and meet with people who you wanted to meet with and pursue your own ideas, you know, all of those things, and not be targeted, and just not be targeted because of your class or your ethnicity or religion or your political views. You know, those are huge things that I learned not to take for granted. You know, I've really learned how fortunate I've been in my own life.
So it's one thing to acknowledge the social determinants of health, but as a physician, as a practitioner, what do you do? Let's say you're confronted with a patient who has had a traumatic experience as a refugee or has had a scarcity of food. Instead of prescribing sort of medicinal solutions, what do you do to acknowledge that these are social determinants? What do you suggest in these situations?
Right, right. Yeah, and one of the last things we hope to do in that situation is prescribing medication. Sometimes it's important, but you know, what we've learned about people who've gone through a lot of trauma and dislocation and so on is that people who've been through things like that need opportunities to reconnect and to reestablish the sense of their own personal groundedness and their own story and their own connections. And finding ways to make sure people have secure housing, employment opportunities, educational opportunities, access to learn, the language of social exchange. And then, if possible, reuniting people with their families that they might have been forced to leave behind. Those kinds of things are critical. So, fortunately, in community health centers where I worked, and this is part of the reason I wanted to work there, we were always multidisciplinary teams, and we always had people on staff like yourself who could do the work of, assisting people in looking for educational or work opportunities, upgrading, doing what, finding secure housing, learning the laws that protect them from workplace exploitation or other kinds of violence. That kind of work is critical, and it's the real healing work. And often that's more, often when we think about healing for people who've been, are refugees because of violence and so on. I should mention that the other place that I still work at is the Center for Victims of Torture in downtown Toronto.
Yeah, I was going to get to that. I used to be a volunteer there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. So, what we in our old ways of thinking, we think about healing as following a path through psychotherapy, maybe group therapy and maybe medication, but those things all can have a role in the right time and place.
Uh-huh.
But most people are going to do best if they can recover their own sense of agency and get their feet on the ground and develop their own social networks, their own employment networks, their own independence. That's usually the best route. Seems to be the best route to healing.
And also just the sense of having a kind of de-traumatized social connection. That was my experience when I was a befriender at CCVT. Just having social connection, simple social connection, seemed very important, or at least that's the impression I got when I was a volunteer.
Absolutely. It's really important because one of the things that you learn when you're really traumatized, and one of the things that very oppressive governments try to do to people is really isolate them, make them feel that no one can help them, no one cares about them, no one knows where they are. So people can lose trust in they might crave human relationships and human closeness, but that might be a very scary thing. So. Kind of gradually getting the opportunity to build trusting and trustworthy relationships that's really key. And that happens with experience. And in many ways, doing that through a befriending program or, through community organizations or other kinds of networks, sometimes religious gatherings, those kind of relationships in some ways have a more authentic impact than a relationship with a person who's a professional and kind of paid to be trustworthy.
Right.
So, all of those things have their place, but the real reconnecting socially is really, really important.
It's really wonderful to hear you speak as a physician from the perspective of having this holistic sense of healing, that prescribing medicine is just one aspect of this totality. It's really great to hear that coming from you. It's refreshing. I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about Justice for Migrant Workers, because that's the way I was connected with you, through Moylan at Justice for Migrant Workers. What is your connection with that organization? I assume it's in your work trying to get healthcare for uninsured people, including, of course, migrant workers.
Yeah, and I'll have to say my link to them. First of all, I really really admire the work, the hard work, and the good work that they're doing. My relationship with them is very informal. Mm. When the pandemic started, you know, there was a kind of a loose coalition of people who were concerned about what was going to happen during the pandemic to people who didn't have health insurance. And you know, some of us were health professionals, some were community advocates, some are researchers, there's some students. Anyway, I'm sure I'm leaving some people out.
Right.
But we kind of came from a variety of backgrounds and have just tried through different projects to support the access of people who don't have health insurance to get healthcare through through the pandemic and hopefully beyond. You know, hopefully that will become a normalized practice in our society. That has benefits for everybody.
I was talking.
Yeah, but so my.
Sorry, go on.
No, I'm just to say that, you know, I don't have a formal relationship with them, but you know, my work in the last year during the pandemic, most of my personal work, professional work, has been focused in working in long-term care homes and then a bit up here and a bit in the community health center. You know, it hasn't been as focused on working with uninsured people nearly as much as the great workers that you've been talking about.
In terms of healthcare during the pandemic, I was actually speaking to a healthcare worker a couple of weeks ago who told me the fact that there is a mandate for hospitals and I think even clinics to treat people regardless of their status, regardless of whether they have OHIP or not. Has this program been successful in your mind? Has this worked out? Has it been an effective program during the pandemic?
Well, I think there's going to be a lot of ongoing evaluation about how effective that's been. And, you know, because I know that the communication to hospitals and inside of hospitals, that those barriers were supposed to disappear. That's been really patchy. It might be getting better as time goes on. I'm actually not the best person to tell you that, but I know there have been lots of instances where, people at administrative desks or healthcare providers weren't aware that they were supposed to provide non-insured people with care in the hospitals. But lots of other people have been aware and people have been getting care. I mean, I think another failure, you know, the government did quite early on promulgate that policy. But what they didn't do or what they did very ineffectively was communicate that to the populations who needed to hear that message, the populations who needed to know that it was that they could go and seek health care at the hospital and they wouldn't be charged. It was really, really hard to get that message out, not only to the hospitals and to healthcare providers, but to the populations who, you know, would benefit from it.
So a lot of it was a communication problem.
Yeah. I think there were a lot of communication problems, yeah. And, you know, the other thing that the government did was, they didn't make it mandatory, but they did make it possible for people who don't have health insurance to get health care from community physicians who normally would bill OHIP. They created these new billing numbers that physicians could use in community clinics to bill for people who don't have health insurance during the pandemic. You know, they were slow to honor those payments. There was a lot of suspicion about whether the government would really follow through. I don't know. There were a lot of barriers in that process too. So there have been one of the projects that I was involved in was started by a group of medical students and some of us. And we just called a lot of clinics across Toronto, especially and Ontario, especially walk-in clinics, to see if they were aware of those billing codes and if they were seeing people who didn't have health insurance. And, you know, this was a year ago, and maybe 30-35% of the clinics were aware that they could see uninsured people and bill for it and were doing so. It was a pretty, you know, low number.
Wow.
So, you know, again, I think from a public health point of view, the government brought in the right policies, but in terms of making sure that they were effective and that the communication got out and so on, I don't think that they did great.
A couple questions come to mind immediately. For example, say at the clinic you work at, do you take down information from people who are uninsured? And is this information then shared with the government? I would imagine there would be some fear among the uninsured or migrant workers of both around this, the sharing of their personal information.
Yes, I absolutely know what you're talking about. And I can't really tell you what kind of information the hospitals would be taking down. And at the health center where I worked, we've been providing uninsured people with free healthcare for years, and we actually had a government budget to allow us to do that. And we would take people's name and address and phone number and stuff like that. And, you know, under privacy legislation, that information, you know, it would be illegal for that to get into anybody else's hands. But the fear that it might get into other people's hands is very understandable.
Mm. Interesting.
Yeah. So on the side of the clinics, I mean, there is sometimes a reason to gather information. We need to be able to follow up with people and
all that.
And the government does collect data and, you know, to evaluate things. There's legitimate reasons to collect information, but there's also people's very legitimate fears about what will happen to that information.
That's right.
Whether or not they're told it's going to be protected, you know.
And then the other question I have is, when there is a so-called return to normalcy, do you think that this mandate to treat the uninsured will continue, or do you think that it will end as the pandemic ends?
Yeah, I am mildly optimistic that it might be continued. But I, you know, I fear that after all this is over, the more conservative governments anyways are going to be really putting out a message that we all need to tighten our belts. We've spent a lot of money. We're deep in debt. And they'll be looking for ways to cut costs wherever they can. And, you know, for a conservative government, providing health care access to people who don't have status, that's probably not too popular with their base. So I'm a little skeptical about that. But it's possible that, you know, that kind of government won't be in power. And it's also possible that that researchers and public health people and advocates are going to put together the kind of data and information that shows that really it is in everybody's interest to have everybody have access to healthcare, to be healthy, to be safe. You know, I believe that's true, but our present mindset in our society puts such a high value on you know, well, does it make economic sense? But, you know, somehow that becomes the top question. And for me, maybe it does make economic sense, and maybe it doesn't, but it sure makes moral sense and it makes public health sense. I would advocate for it either way.
We can only hope, because this would certainly be a positive outcome after the pandemic. I'd like to let you go soon, but I just have a sort of generalized question. You certainly have had an amazing trajectory, a really ethical and social justice-oriented approach to caregiving. I'm wondering, how did you get here? Have you always been on this side of the ethical equation? What was the impetus for this kind of approach to medicine? How did you get here?
Yeah, you know, probably, David, probably I was. I grew up in quite a religious Mennonite family, and I dropped a lot of the religion as I got older, but I did keep a lot of the social values and principles that I was taught as a kid. And I think when I got interested in medicine, like many people who go into medicine and healthcare and lots of fields like social work, you know, people go in because they want to do, you know, they want a satisfying career, but they also want to do good for other people and for society.
Yeah.
I was like that. And, you know, fortunately, I met a bunch of other like-minded people in medical school. I found mentors who had similar ideas. And then I found my way into community health centers where, you know, that was kind of the prevailing culture and philosophy. It was one of those things where, I really believe that humans have a lot in common with plants. We need to find the right soil, the right amount of light and water and nurture, and then we're able to give something back. You know, it all goes back and forth. I've been very fortunate to have the opportunities that I've had, and then also very fortunate to have really great, supportive people around me.
Dr. Wendell Block, that is a magnificent place to stop. A wonderful philosophy, a wonderful ethic. And on behalf of Radio Region, I really thank you for talking with me this evening.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's my pleasure, David. And it's so great that you're putting these kind of conversations on the radio. Fantastic.
Well, that's great to hear. Have a good night.
You too.